Stockholm, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Shooting attack in the Akbar al-Quds leaves several Israeli settlers wounded. This amid tensions following the recent Israeli aggression in Gaza and the West Bank. Meantime, pro-Palestine activists rally in Austria's capital to condemn Israel's latest deadly assault on the besieged Gaza Strip. We'll have a report. Also in the headlines, North Korea is slamming the UN chief's comments about the denuclearization of Pyongyang, saying his words lack impartiality and fairness. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, beginning this news hour with the occupied East al-Quds, where there's been a shooting incident. At least 9 people are said to have sustained injuries. 3 of them are in critical condition. The pre-dawn incident happened when a gunman opened fire on a bus in the old city of al-Quds. Israeli officials are branding it a terrorist attack. Regime forces say that the shooter is in custody after a 6-hour chase. His family members are also under arrest. Gaza-based Palestinian resistance movements have hailed the attack as courageous. Hamas is calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians and holy Muslim sites. The Islamic Jihad says it's part of resistance against the occupiers. Early this month, a 3-day Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip killed nearly 50 Palestinians. Israeli forces have also recently stepped up raids in the West Bank, killing some 60 people since late March. Over the same period, attacks on Israeli targets have killed 19 people. Now from Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil has more about what happened.
A Palestinian man opened fire at an Israeli bus, then in the same area, He opened fire at 2 other vehicles, wounding at least 9 Israeli settlers. This area was very close to Ha'at al-Buraq in the old town of Al-Quds, near the Al-Aqsa Mosque, of course. This area that the Israelis called the Western world for the Palestinians and for the Muslims, it's Ha'at al-Ghurab. Following this incident, Israeli troops were dispatched to a Silwan neighborhood in Al-Quds, surrounding the Palestinian neighborhood of Silwan and conducting searches from house to another, with more Israeli soldiers and troops being deployed around Silwan and in the streets of Al-Quds and the old town of Al-Quds. As we received now, after 6 hours of the search, the Israeli troops arrested a man in Silwan, and they claim that he was responsible for the shooting. The Israelis also are speaking about a Palestinian man carried out the shooting. Another one helped him to get out from the Al-Aqsa Mosque area and the old town to Al-Quds neighborhoods.
Now, that was a Ramallah correspondent. Our correspondent Gaza, Sir Ashraf Shannon, also tells us how the news of the attack was received in the blockaded Palestinian territory.
Palestinian resistance groups have welcomed the shooting operation in occupied Al-Quds, describing it as a heroic operation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum said that the operation Al-Quds is a natural response to the arrogance of the Israeli regime and the crimes of the settlers and the daily attacks against Palestinians. And he also said that the Palestinians are fully aware that only resistance, specifically armed resistance, is the best way to fight the occupation and liberate Palestinian lands. Another Hamas official in charge of the Al-Quds file, Mohammed Hamada, he said that this operation comes in response to the massacre that the Israeli regime carried out in Gaza over a week ago, and also to the assassination of a Palestinian resistance fighter in Nablus.
The pro-Palestine activists have taken to the streets of the Austrian capital amid international fury over Israel's murderous bombing of Gaza that saw scores of innocent civilians killed. Our correspondent Robert Carter has traveled to Vienna and witnessed local actionists' demands for justice continue to grow.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in 3-4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel. And that's what we are doing here also, is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In other news, Iranian Foreign Ministry says that the language of threats used by the United States will not work against its country and its people. Hossein Amir Abdullahian urges the White House to stop playing a blame game against Iran. It says this will not bring the U.S. impunity from the numerous terrorist crimes it's committed against thousands of people in Iran and the wider region. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Iran of severe consequences if it attacks Americans, including former government officials. A day before, the U.S. Justice Department announced criminal charges against an Iranian national for allegedly recruiting an assassin to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Tehran calls the allegations political and denies any involvement in any such plot. Salman Rushdie, the author of a highly controversial anti-Islam book, has reportedly been taken off the ventilator, is unable to talk, and that a day after he was seriously wounded in an attack. Rushdie was stabbed on stage during an event in New York on Friday. The 24-year-old suspect, Hadi Matar, has pleaded not guilty to charges of attempted murder and assault. A lawyer entered a plea on his behalf during a formal hearing at a court in New York. U.S. prosecutors are remanding Matar, who is from New Jersey, in custody without bail. Rushdie published his sacrilegious novel, The Satanic Verses, in the late 80s. The blasphemous passages in the book triggered an outcry across the Muslim world. The political commentator Mohsen Abbas says that Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West in order to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam. On Islam, the real Islam, which talks about justice and talks about governments, which should be just, and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious, perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
North Korea criticizes the UN chief's call for the full and verifiable denuclearization of Pyongyang during a visit to the neighboring South. The North has dismissed the remarks by Antonio Guterres as dangerous, accusing him of supporting the hostile policy of the United States. According to Pyongyang, the UN chief's comments lack impartiality and fairness. North Korea says an irreversible denuclearization of the country would be a breach of its sovereignty. Guterres, who was in South Korea on a two-day visit, expressed his commitment to the denuclearization of the North, calling it a fundamental objective to bring peace, security, and stability to the whole region. Washington and Seoul have for a while raised concerns about Pyongyang preparing to carry out what would be its seventh nuclear test. Thousands of South Korean progressives and unionists have gathered in downtown Seoul to protest joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises scheduled for August 22nd. Labor leaders call for the end of such exercises, warning the Korean Peninsula is inching toward a nuclear war. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land, and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In an unprecedented incident, the FBI searched former President Trump's residence in Florida earlier this week. A search warrant unsealed by a judge says the top secret files were seized from Trump's estate. Trump is accused of violating rules on official records, something that he denies. The former president and his Republican allies have accused the FBI of being corrupt and politicized.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
The FBI search of Trump's estate has drawn fierce rhetoric from the former president and his allies that pledged to hold the Biden administration to account. And that, as reports say, that FBI agents were looking for classified documents related to nuclear weapons.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years. Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
Pelosi's recent trip to Taiwan shows U.S. hypocrisy towards the fundamental rights of other nations, says Kahan International Staff Writer in an article published under the heading China to Teach Pelosi an Unforgettable Lesson. Stay tuned for more. It seems Beijing is determined to teach Washington an unforgettable lesson for the recent violation of China's sovereignty and territorial integrity
by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is clearly guilty of trespassing for visiting Taiwan. Throughout history, trespassing has been regarded as an act of crime, which is punishable under the common laws of each and every country. Even in the United States of America, if someone is caught trespassing on another person's property, he or she is liable to face trouble, including physical thrashing and possibly a civil lawsuit. A week ago, the aging American lady who claims to be a lawgiver openly violated China's law and has entered Taipei without Beijing's authorization, despite warnings from the senior military and civilian officials of her own country. Pelosi's recent trip to Taiwan shows U.S. hypocrisy towards the fundamental rights of other nations. China's Vice Foreign Minister Xi Feng had called her visit as playing with fire, adding, "The move is extremely egregious in nature and the consequences are extremely serious. China will not sit idly by." It is indeed sheer hypocrisy that the U.S., which claims to be a supporter of peace, human rights, and respect for other countries, feels no inhibitions in violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of world nations. This is not something surprising of a regime which these very days of August, 77 years ago, had committed the unpardonable act of terrorism by dropping two atom bombs within a space of 3 days on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when World War II was practically over and Japanese troops in full retreat from the southeastern Asian fronts. Washington has never ceased its acts of international terrorism, which in 1970s witnessed the brutal war in Vietnam. Today also it is creating chaos all over the world, whether it is Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Bahrain, Libya, Ukraine, and East Asia, let alone its complicity in the unabated crimes of the illegal Zionist entity against Palestinians, Lebanese, Syrians, and the rest of humanity. With this in mind, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin has recently blasted Pelosi's visit to Taiwan on the pretext of defending democratic values as a major political provocation, and said the visit, which only escalated tensions in the region, had nothing to do with democracy. He called on the U.S. House Speaker to express remorse and apologize for the atrocities committed by the Americans in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and other countries. Wang pointed out that her visit had nothing to do with democracy and was a political trick that ran counter to the will of 1.4 billion Chinese people, including the Taiwanese, who believe in the One China policy. He added, "If Pelosi cares so much about democracy and human rights, she'd better visit Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, where she could express repentance for the killings of hundreds of thousands of civilians by the U.S. military. She could also promise those countries that similar atrocities that resulted from a U.S. violation of the U.N. Charter and international law norms will never, ever be repeated." And all this indicates that momentum is building in China to teach Pelosi, if not the entire American regime, a memorable lesson for the U.S. House Secretary's latest crime. And all this indicates that momentum is building in China to teach Pelosi, if not the entire American regime, a memorable lesson for the U.S. House Speaker's latest crime against humanity.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Internet trolls.
Part 2.
The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called Internet trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue, and if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called troll by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us anywhere can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, he could be going to jail.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, there's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. Is really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. They got this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions?
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University of Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and alt.tasteless was born.
When I used Twitter, I used it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. And I just used it every way possible. One day I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up. Chris Murphy, Gregory's lawyer, explains how Gregory went from volunteering to design a logo for a feminist organization to being arrested and jailed for 3 days.
When Greg called me, he had no idea why the police were there, and neither did I, obviously. And it wasn't until sometime after his arrest, when he was in custody, that he first learned what the police were doing there. And it turned out that there was a woman named Steph Guthrie who had said that Mr. Elliott had been criminally harassing her on Twitter. The medium that Mr. Elliott is alleged to have harassed the complainant, Ms. Guthrie, is on Twitter. That's it. No personal emails, not Facebook, nothing in person, no in-person meetings, no stalking behavior.
There's the one they threw coffee on. You can throw coffee on it, but creating the picture is worth more than 1,000 people destroying it. This is like freedom of speech. This is saying, you know, like, I can comment on what you're doing as long as it's not a threat. You know, if you're hurt, if the truth hurts you, it's not my problem, because I'm just telling the truth.
Mr. Elliott was disagreeing with Stephanie Guthrie's politics. She's the founder of a political organization in Toronto called Women in Toronto Politics.
Mr. Elliot was an ally of hers for a number of months. But then there was a break in the relationship because Mr. Elliot stuck up for someone he believed was being bullied by Miss Guthrie and her friends on Twitter.
Miss Guthrie, who refused to be interviewed for this film, asked her followers to, quote, sick the internet on a young man who had made an anti-feminist video game, a game that even Mr. Elliot admits was clearly offensive.
There was an orchestrated and dangerous attack on this guy. Right up to that point, I was sending tweets to them saying, look, the guy only has 11 followers. Ignore it. It's not good branding, you know, to destroy people's lives. But they said, screw you, Greg. And I said, okay, well, you're not going to take me seriously. You're not going to stop. I sent a tweet that I'm going to paraphrase it. It said, if you commit suicide, I'm holding you all responsible. And at that point, my helping stopped, the attack started, and I had to start defending.
Gregory didn't know what he was up against. A community had labeled him a troll, and they were determined to get rid of him.
I knew they were trying to get me kicked off Twitter. So at first it was a campaign of intimidation. Second, it was fake identities, using my face and names that were similar to my names, and that's illegal. And if I had felt like it, I could have got whoever did it kicked off Twitter. But then it was the hashtag GAE hole, Gregory Allen Elliott, so gay hole. So this was an orchestrated campaign that ramped up.
Gregory fought back with tweets that were often abrasive and confrontational, but he never broke Twitter's terms of service. That hasn't stopped the justice system from charging him with criminal harassment and imposing bail conditions, taking away his internet use for 3 years.
So what I've had to do for the 3 years, because I was banned from the internet and banned from email, is I've had to rely on family and friends and try and cut into their lives and schedules. Yeah, and to be forced back onto a pencil and erasers is very interesting.
I've spent, I couldn't even count, thousands of hours like this, sitting like this, out of my own time, because he was not able to do his own evidence gathering for his case.
So you have to, the most painful thing is having to go through stream of consciousness blather on Twitter. Not exciting for me, and I can imagine it's even less exciting for everyone that was helping me out, so.
Sifting through the intricate web of thousands of tweets and retweets made one thing abundantly clear to Gregory's lawyer, Chris Murphy.
Gregory Allen Elliott is not a troll. There's no way. He is either communicating a political message or he's defending himself against their slander. Those two things do not make you a troll. He wasn't going near them physically, wasn't saying anything threatening, wasn't saying anything sexual to them. He was communicating about politics, and he was following the rules on Twitter.
But because Gregory wouldn't shut up, his accusers went to the police, saying that they felt threatened. Now Gregory waits for the judge to decide his fate. Freedom or 6 months behind bars.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out, because nobody will be safe. What you're gonna do, if you're involved in a political conversation online and the mob comes to shut you up, you better shut up. Because if you don't, you could be going to jail.
Internet trolling has two essential parts, the attack and your reaction. A big reaction is what the trolls crave, and the way you respond determines whether or not you are a worthwhile target.
If it's just somebody that's just going to, you know, block us and that's the end of the game, well, you guys suck. That doesn't provide too much entertainment.
Prolific troll Wild Goose and the Wagoner crew are all about the lulls, the laughs their victims provide. They call them lulls cows, so there's a logical limit to how far they'll push them.
There's a symbiotic relationship between the internet troll and the lulz cow. The Bill Wagoner crew has never pushed anyone towards suicide, nor have we tried to. That's never our intent. Why would we kill a perfectly good lulz cow? if we were to knock them off the internet or out of real life, what benefit would that provide us? You know, how are we going to get any lulls out of someone who's 6 feet underground? You know, last I looked, dead people don't come on the internet.
Stay-at-home mom and professional blogger Gina Crossley Corcoran faces a politically motivated faction among her trolls. They disagree with her opinions on home birth, breastfeeding, and the healthcare system, and they want to drive her blog off the internet altogether.
I have a large reach, but I don't feel like it somehow makes me better than anybody or makes me some sort of powerful figure, but they see it as very powerful, and that's why they want to shut it down.
A few years ago, a coordinated trolling campaign drove away all of Gina's sponsors.
There were a couple of brands that hung on, but ultimately they were like, listen, these people are flooding our Facebook page with negative comments and hateful comments and talking about our families now, and we just can't do it. So suddenly, almost overnight, I had no income base, but I had what had become an expensive blog to run.
Gina took a chance and put up a paywall. Fortunately, it turned out that most of her audience was willing to pay to be part of the feminist breeder community. But the frustrated trolls have since stooped to new lows.
One of them called the police and told them that I was committing suicide. So the police showed up at my house at like 3 a.m, woke me up out of bed, and said, we got an anonymous tip that you are suicidal and we have to put you under a 72-hour psych hold. So I was being thrown in the back of an ambulance, crying, you know, upset, afraid my children were gonna wake up and see mommy being taken away. Luckily, I was able to talk to the EMT and I explained to him, like, listen, this person you're saying from Twitter, this person doesn't know me. Please don't take me anywhere. I have kids to wake up to in the morning. And luckily, he sort of saw the situation for what it was, and he, you know, let me out of the ambulance and said, okay, go back to bed. So I found out from the police that anyone can make a call and say that they're worried about you committing suicide, or they're worried about your children's welfare, and anyone can make an anonymous tip. They don't have to leave their name. So there's really nothing, legally speaking, that I can do about that. My trolls realized that was a good way to use my own local police to harass me and get me out of bed at 3 a.m. In the course of a year, it happened 3 times. So I went to the police and I said, this has to be illegal. And, you know, the local police's response was basically, well, if you don't like it, get off the internet.
When the police cannot or will not help, there is another place that trolling victims can turn.
Nice to meet you.
Please come have a seat.
The victims I deal with come to us very frustrated. They're frustrated with the situation because they feel helpless.
Roman Horak is lead forensic investigator at InfoTransec, an international cybersecurity firm. He tracks down the trolls that law enforcement won't or can't find.
The reasons why the police won't engage the case is because they won't believe there's enough of a serious threat, or they won't have, the person themselves won't have enough evidence.
I've been getting a lot of people threatening me online, and it's scary. I'm not really sure what to do with this.
What sites mainly are they threats coming through on?
Mostly Twitter, but there's a couple on Facebook.
Okay. One of the big questions is understanding the motive of the troll. There's some trolls out there just scrolling the internet looking for someone random to, you know, harass. However, the vast majority of trolls that we deal with are someone who they know. They would have had a relationship somehow with the offender.
Indeed, in the course of their investigations, Roman and his team have discovered that it is people we know, family and friends and workmates, who are most often behind the heinous attacks we can face. But Roman's team has also uncovered a new, more dangerous type of player in the trolling game. Professional trolls. Those who can be hired to settle a score and attack others for money.
Online trolls for hire. The service is available online, almost like a hitman. Some of the guys are very professional. They even create their own malware targeted to that victim, so they write their own code, and that these guys know what they're doing. These trolls for hire could be pretty much anywhere in the world. Romania or Ukraine, Russia, lots from there. Trying to track them down often becomes an international operation, having to coordinate between different law enforcement in different countries.
But thankfully, the vast majority of trolls are outright amateurs who don't really know how to cover their tracks.
About 85% of people who are doing these things, you know, trolling and harassing people online, are not tech savvy. Most offenders are leaving a vast amount of digital evidence every day. Every second, every minute right now. Pretty much everything we do online is potentially archived.
Many trolls operate with a false sense of security about their anonymity and of the potential consequences they face if exposed. In England, the law has taken a hard stance and a line has been drawn in the digital sand.
Yeah, I sent some tweets in 2014 and ended up getting a 12-week prison sentence for those tweets.
It wasn't her habit to abuse people online, but today, Isabella Sorley is known as one of England's most notorious trolls. So, what was Isabella's online offense? In 2013, feminist activist Carolyn Criado Perez was campaigning to have a woman's face appear on the next printing of the English £10 note. The public reaction was largely positive, but she was also deluged by a torrent of abusive, irrational, and threatening messages on Twitter. Isabella joined that mob.
That particular night, I was incredibly drunk, and I decided to go home and just send tweets. It wasn't about the campaign. I don't really care what's on a British banknote. I know she was campaigning to have a woman, and the Queen's on the banknote anyway, so I did really not care at all what she was campaigning about. Even now, I don't even know why I sent them. I would love to know why, and I'd love to give, like, a clear, like, answer. But the real thing is that I was drunk, and I've just jumped on the bandwagon and followed a lot of other people.
The trolls were not debating. They were spewing hate and attacking Criado Perez personally for her feminist agenda. Isabella added 6 threatening tweets of her own. She threatened rape and worse.
I woke up in the morning, like, obviously worse for wear, realised what I'd done. I was physically sick. I don't know if it was down to the tweets or just the hangover. Like, absolutely vile. Like, what I tweeted was disgusting, so to think that I actually typed that out. I felt disgusted in myself that I'd sent those specific words to another person.
Filled with remorse the night after spewing her online hate, Isabella took to the internet to both confess and say sorry.
I apologized to her, went, look, it is an empty threat, do not worry, I'm sorry. I don't know if it reassured her at all, but kind of it made me feel a little bit better that yeah, she's getting all these other rape and death threats. At least mine is an empty threat. She doesn't have to worry about me falling through with what I said.
But rape and death threats are taken very seriously. 4 months later, Isabella was arrested along with another troll. Her trial was widely publicized and she faced the scorn of a nation.
I got a 12-week prison sentence in Holloway Prison. Hard. It was really hard because obviously, like, how high profile it was, I couldn't hide away. I had all the prisoners asking why I did it. I had all, like, the prison guards asking why I did it. I was getting a lot of abuse from everywhere. I was being made out to be a woman hater, and then obviously I'm in a women's prison, so I was like, oh dear. Now you got my head kicked in because of what someone had saw, what I'd tweeted on the news. I saw myself on Crime Watch in the prison cell, so that was hard.
After her time in jail, Isabella was ordered to do community service and also pay money to Caroline Criado Perez personally for her online attacks.
in the limelight.
At least one lawyer for former President Donald J. Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and club had been returned to the government, four people with knowledge of the document have said. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman, Glenn Thrush, Katie Benner, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump lawyer told Justice Department that classified material had been returned. Please stay with us for more. At least one lawyer for former President Donald J. Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and club had been returned to the government, four people with knowledge of the document have said. The written declaration was made after a visit on 3rd of June to Mar-a-Lago by J. I. Bratt, the top counterintelligence official in the Justice Department's National Security Division. The existence of the signed declaration, which has not previously been reported, is a possible indication that Donald Trump or his team were not fully forthcoming with federal investigators about the material. And it could help explain why a potential violation of a criminal statute related to obstruction was cited by the department as one basis for seeking the search warrant used to carry out the day-long search of the former president's home on Monday, an extraordinary step that generated political shockwaves. It also helps to further explain the sequence of events that prompted the Justice Department's decision to conduct the search after months in which it had tried to resolve the matter through discussions with Donald Trump and his legal team. An inventory of the material taken from Donald Trump's home that was released on Friday showed that FBI agents seized 11 sets of documents during the search with some type of confidential or secret markings on them, including some marked as classified TSSCI, that is shorthand for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information. Information categorized in that fashion is meant to be viewed only in a secure government facility. The search encompassed not just a storage area where boxes of material known to the Justice Department were being held, but also Donald Trump's office and residence. The search warrant and inventory unsealed on Friday did not specify where in the Mar-a-Lago complex the documents marked as classified were found. Donald Trump said on Friday, 12th of August, that he had declassified all the material in his possession while he was still in office. He did not provide any documentation that he had done so. In an appearance on Fox News Channel on Friday night, the right-wing writer John Solomon, whom Donald Trump has designated as one of his representatives to interact with the National Archives, read a statement from the former president's office claiming that Donald Trump had a standing order during his presidency that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them. A spokesman for the former president, Taylor Budowich, which on Saturday, 13th of August, just like every Democrat fabricated witch hunt previously, the water of this unprecedented and unnecessary raid is being carried by a media willing to run with suggestive leaks, anonymous sources, and no hard facts. The search warrant said FBI agents were carrying out the search to look for evidence related to possible violations of obstruction statute, as well as the Espionage Act, and a statute that bars the unlawful taking or destruction of government records or government documents. No one has been charged in the case, and a search warrant on its own does not mean anyone will be charged. Last year, officials with the National Archives discovered that Donald Trump had taken a slew of documents and other government material with him when he left the White House at the end of his tumultuous term in January of 2021. That material was supposed to have been sent to the archives under the terms of the Presidential Records Act. Mr. Trump returned 15 boxes of material in January of this year. When archivists examined the material, they found many pages of documents with classified markings and referred the matter to the Justice Department, which began an investigation and convened a grand jury. In the spring, the Justice Department issued a subpoena to Donald Trump seeking additional documents that it believed may have been in his possession. The former president was repeatedly urged by advisers to return what remained, despite what they described as his desire to continue to hold onto some of the documents. In an effort to resolve the dispute, Mr. Bratt and other officials visited Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida in early June, briefly meeting Donald Trump while they were there. Two of Donald Trump's lawyers, M. Evan Corcoran and Christina Bobb, spoke with Mr. Bratt and a small number of investigators he traveled with, people briefed on the meeting said. Evan Corcoran and Christina Bobb showed Mr. Bratt and his team boxes holding material that Donald Trump had taken from the White House that were being kept in a storage area, the people said. According to two people briefed on the visit, Mr. Bratt and his team left with additional material marked classified, and around that time also obtained a written declaration from a Trump lawyer attesting that all the material marked classified in the boxes had been turned over. A short time after the meeting, according to people briefed on it,